Crime Curious is a true crime podcast that takes an in-depth look into real cases through the lens of a trained investigator and former prosecutor turned judge.
If you are sensitive to expletives, anatomical descriptions, and accurate descriptions of crime scenes, this podcast may not be suitable for you.
Welcome to Crime Curious. I'm Charnel.
I'm Megan.
We're shaking our gree-grees.
As always.
Yes. Hi. How are you today, Megan?
I'm well, Nell. And how are you?
I'm fine. I'm just fine.
You're wearing a sweatshirt that says good vibe with a rainbow.
Yeah. And do you see
I'm wearing a Red Wings sweatshirt.
I see that.
Go Wings.
Do you see how this has a bluish tint to it?
Did you wash your laundry inappropriately?
Accidentally. I didn't realize this cream sweatshirt was in with my jeans.
Yeah, it'll do it.
And it bled. So, luckily, I just ordered it off of Temu for $9.99.
Yeah.
And I have a new one coming.
I love it.
It is very comfortable.
That's literally when you're just like, it's from Temu, throw it out, I'll order a new one.
I will order a new one because I can't handle the blue tinge on my beautiful cream sweater. So.
I only noticed it on that arm, to be honest with you, in the light. Otherwise, if you wouldn't have mentioned it, I would not have thought that you had a laundry mishap.
Nope. It was a faux pas. 40 years old, still don't know how to check for whites in my darks.
Yeah, I've been there.
Ugh, and there's a separate laundry hamper and everything. I don't know how she ended up in there, but...
Blame one of the boys.
I can't. It's in my own bedroom where they never go.
Son of a bitch.
But we could blame the husband. Let's
it's
do
hard
that.
When you only have yourself to blame.
I know.
Right? Well,
somehow I
just... You blame it on him and he'll be like, it wasn't me. And I didn't say it was your fault. I said I was going to blame you.
Absolutely. And you know, he would look at me and say, you think I picked something up and right. put it in the laundry hamper?
Exactly.
No, it was you.
It was wishful thinking, Matt. I thought maybe you did
maybe.
Laundry.
Nope. All right. Okay. Here we're going to jump in, Megan.
You're giving me trauma right off the bat.
I am. And I love our listeners because the case that I'm covering today, it's not super long because it's not one that has just a ton of information to be had. But that doesn't mean that it is any less deserving of being covered. And our listeners know that. And so they beautifully recommend cases knowing that, hey, actually, I think the lovely person who recommended this, I don't have permission to use their name, even said, there's not a whole lot out there, but this is super tragic. And
it deserves and I to
think,
be told.
Yes, that it should be told. And it's so true because this is really the random and senseless murder of Alexandra Zapp, who was simply at the wrong place at the wrong time, and she deserves to be remembered, and her story deserves to be told.
And I don't like these cases because they remind us that at any given time, life is short, and we might not be here tomorrow.
Absolutely. It's so very precious, and what is the word I'm looking for? Apparently, I need more coffee. Delicate?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a snap of the finger. Everything changes, right? When you see photos of Alexandra, she literally radiates sweet energy. Like, she just has this truly genuine and kind smile. And I was drawn in from her picture right away of, oh my gosh, she's just this sweetness. And when you see her, like, you, I guarantee you'll feel the same way. It's just like this really gentle sweetness about her. But Alexandra Zapp was born August 24th, 1971 in West Portland, Oregon, where she was also raised. She's the daughter of Raymond and Andrea Zapp. Alexandra left Portland in 1988 to attend Miss Porter's boarding school in Connecticut. She has a formal education all through her.
My thought is one of her parents must have been an East Coaster. That's kind of an East Coast thing to do boarding schools.
I would think so. Her mother's maiden name was Casanova. Oh, so I even wonder if it might have been her mom. Me too. After completing her high school education, she returned to Oregon to attend the University of Oregon for 2 years. And then she actually decided that she was going to accept a position, an editing position, back out east in Boston, Massachusetts.
Okay.
Yeah, so she moves back there. And something that I don't know if this was just instilled in her as she was growing up, if it was part of her boarding school education, but, or just the sweetness that I referred to earlier, because she was always involved in charities and volunteering her time.
I love this.
You're going to love her, and then it's just so freaking sad what happens.
I just gave a talk to some local successful high school students from a town near us, mm-hmm. where I talked about success. They want to know about my success, of course, and then reaching maximum potential. And a lot of what I talked about was serving your community and getting involved, mm-hmm. no matter where you are.
Right.
So Boston may not have been her hometown, but she started diving right in to become involved in the community. People like that are important.
Yeah. Well, while she was in Boston, she participated in charity organizations such as the French Library, the Boston Ballet, and the Courageous Sailing Center, where she donated her time teaching children to sail. She was an avid sailor. She loved sailing.
I would hang out with her.
Yes.
We would be friends.
Yes. So she, in November 2001, she decided to make a move to Newport, Rhode Island to take a job with U.S. Sailing. I believe she was a trainer.
Wow.
There.
So she's an avid trainer. And a lot of the reason, she probably, going to boarding school on the East Coast, rowing and boating, mm-hmm. and those are very important sports there.
Yep. It's funny that you say sports, because I was like, is this a sport? Is it an activity? Is it, it's leisure, competitive, and pleasure all in one.
All in one. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have regattas. These are mm-hmm. these are very competitive things.
And I just love how she goes, you know, she's back in Oregon. Then she's like, I'm going to take this editing job in Boston. Well, now I'm going to go to Newport, Rhode Island and do this, be a trainer at the for sailors.
She turned her hobby into a career. And I love that about her too.
And I like that she's just not afraid to have life take her to new places and changes. And she just embraces the doors that are opening for her. She just walks right through them. We all should be so brave.
Right.
For a while, Alexandra was happy working as a trainer for the U.S. Sailing and still keeping up with her charity work and living in Newport. Then in 2002, she gets an opportunity to move to New Zealand.
Oh my God.
I know.
That is even more amazing. Yep. She's going to go intercontinental now.
She was going to work with America's Cup organization. She was going to be on that boat. Apparently there's a boat.
There
too.
Is taking mm-hmm. sailing to an international mm-hmm. level.
So she had actually quit her job with U.S. Sailing to take this exciting new venture on in New Zealand. But she had some time between jobs, so she continued her charity work just prior moving to New Zealand. And spoiler alert, she never makes it to New Zealand. The tragedy happens before she's able to make that move.
I hate this.
I know.
Somebody had life plans and goals, and she had been moving Big through ones. Them since she was in high school, mm-hmm. and something stopped it.
On July 17th, 2002... Alexandra attended a charity cruise in Boston with a friend who worked for Boston Magazine. After the cruise, the two attended a concert and called it a night about 11 p.m. when he dropped her off at her car. He actually apologized for the fact that they had not had a chance to eat very much, but she laughed it off and said, "No worries, I can always stop at the Burger King on the way on her way home to Newport, Rhode Island."
Always a Burger King or a McDonald's.
Right? We were just saying that the other day. It's where murderers go before they murder. Around midnight, Alexandra pulled off at a rest stop that housed a Burger King and restrooms. After ordering a cheeseburger, she actually returned to her car to sleep for a few hours before resuming her drive to Newport.
Oh, she had decided she was a little too tired to mm-hmm. continue.
Yep. Shortly after 4 a.m., she woke up. She decided to use the restroom one more time before finishing the drive back to Rhode Island. She had such a bright future ahead of her. She was smart. She was kind. She was loved. And the odds of her ever coming into contact with the person who ultimately takes her life had to be astonishingly low. They never would have crossed paths in social settings, that's for sure. When Alexandra was opening the bathroom door to exit it, she was met face to face with what I can only describe as that liquid garbage goo that's found at the bottom of a dumpster.
Oh, that was him.
That was him. This goo's name was Paul Leahy. And before I tell you what he did to Alexandra, I will tell you about why he was even at a Burger King at 4 a.m. to begin with.
And it's a Burger King / rest stop, yeah. One of those ones on the yeah. side of the highway.
Yes, but he is an employee of Burger King.
Okay.
So Paul worked as a cook at the Burger King. He had the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift. He was not working this shift to get himself through school or even as a second job to support a family. He was simply an ex-convict who worked there to take what he could get, and take whatever he could get is exactly what he did. His criminal history dates back to 1981. He had a significant history of sexual offenses beginning in 1984. Some of his victims were as young as 13 years old. He served 13 of an 8 to 15 year term for an aggravated rape at knife point of a 21-year-old woman who worked in a Pizza Hut restaurant. As he tried to strangle her, a customer actually walked in, allowing the victim to escape, thankfully. A few years after he was released from prison, Paul Leahy was charged with lewd and lascivious behavior, accosting a person of the opposite sex after he allegedly demanded oral sex from an underage girl. He was on probation for a DUI at the time, and he was ordered to serve 6 months behind bars on a probation violation. The Plymouth County District Attorney's Office sought to have Paul Leahy civilly committed in a petition filed in October 2001, which was just 9 months before the fateful day that he sees Alexandra. A judge dismissed it, however, criticizing the prosecutors for failing to include an opinion by a mental health professional, which I get that. I know we don't like it, but nope. I do understand it, okay? And the only reason we don't like it is because hindsight is always 20/20. But I do understand where the judge is coming from of you can't have somebody committed without the recommendation of a mental health professional. You shouldn't. I mean, in good conscience, this judge.
There are laws and yep. rules in place, and mm-hmm. you usually have to have two physician certifications.
Yep. Prosecutors actually responded by filing an amended petition, this time including a report from a psychologist who agreed with the assessment that Paul Leahy would be a great risk of committing another offense if he was released into the community. Despite the report, the judge still denied the petition. The statute provides for civil commitment of defendants if they are serving a sentence for sexual assault. At that time, Paul Leahy was incarcerated for accosting or annoying a person of the opposite sex in conjunction with a sentence for drunk driving.
All right. It was a technicality on the plea.
It is. It fell short of the requirement yep. for a statutory offense.
It can be one of the most frustrating things to look at with the prosecution because they have sole prosecutorial discretion mm-hmm. and they can reduce something or make a plea bargain. And often when you plead away the sexual type offense that would have allowed for the judge to have considered that petition, right. you plead it to something that then all of a sudden we can't use. It doesn't meet the criteria.
Yep, that's exactly what happened here. And like I said, we know hindsight is always 20/20. And obviously, if things had went different in the fall of 2001, he never would have been in that Burger King restaurant in July 2002 at the same time that Alexandra was. But alas, he was free and he was just working.
Those are often the only places that felons, ex-cons, can get employment, by the way.
Yeah. And I mean, I get it. Like, they do have to be able to be employed
somewhere.
Me too.
And it's probably a requirement of his parole or probation that he be employed.
Yep. But I think what bothers me about it is that we know that he is a sexual offender, and having that 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift, boy, it does leave things vulnerable. I mean, this was just kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah.
It is there's not as many patrons that come and go between those hours. And he was stalking the women's bathroom, Megan, because he's a perpetrator.
Well, you know, he may have even, as she served her cheeseburger, realizes that person never left the parking lot. Instead, she took a nap. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could have been stalking her for hours.
He absolutely was. Oh, yes, definitely. So he was watching and waiting for her, okay? Just as she's coming out of the bathroom, then he actually pushes the door and her, like, back, okay? He claims at this time he was considering whether or not that he was going to rob her, but he had already taken out his knife by the time Alexandra opened the door to leave. She came face to face with him and began to scream. Paul Leahy forced her back into the bathroom and attempted to cover her mouth with his hand. A battle ensued, during which Alexandra tells Paul, "You've stabbed me." Okay, he's physically using this knife at this point in time. And I don't know if she just said that more out of shock than anything, but she was bleeding and a fight continued. Paul Leahy went to the sink to wash his hands and asked Alexandra why she was doing this. All he wanted to do was rob her. Now, Alexandra was smart. She tried to find a way out and to appease him, so she suggested that they pretend that Paul rescued her from another assailant.
Okay, because there's probably still people working at the Burger King in the rest area?
Yeah, yeah, he's not the only worker there. I mean, I'm sure it's skeleton crew.
Sure.
But she needs medical attention. He has now stabbed her repeatedly, and she is on the floor trying to reason with him, trying to save her own life, essentially. It is like, let me go, and I will make you out to be the hero. I will let everybody know that you were rescuing me from someone who got away.
Okay.
Paul decided that no one was going to believe that story because even he knows that he's dumpster goo and that he certainly looks like someone who would perpetrate upon a woman.
He's not wrong.
Alexandra knew at that point in time that she had no other choice, so she made a run for the bathroom door, but Paul caught her, dragged her back to the sink area, and continued to stab her again. Paul later claims that he thought he only stabbed her twice more in the forearm, but we will get to that.
Her injuries.
Uh-huh. After stabbing her, Paul dragged her into a stall, picked up her wallet from the floor, which only had $25 in it, by the way, and again began to wash the blood off his hands and arms. At this point, an off-duty state police lieutenant named Stephen O'Reilly had heard the muffled screams and at least two thuds while he was in the adjacent men's restroom. And when he walked out, he observed drops of blood just outside of the women's door. So he opened the door. Alexandra's blood was visible throughout the entire bathroom. So O'Reilly demands to know what's going on. And Paul Leahy knew at that point in time. He's still holding, like, he's washing his hands. He's got the wallet right there.
And a knife.
And a knife. He responded, "I lost it. I lost it." So Lieutenant O'Reilly apprehended Paul, and he was taken into custody and read his Miranda warnings.
God bless off-duty police officers. Right? And like, God dang it that he wasn't there just quicker. But it's not his fault. That's not.
No.
Timing again.
It is. It absolutely is. I mean, he was just stopping by to use the restroom.
Do you know how many people would have just kept walking, though?
Yes.
And wouldn't done a thing?
Yes.
His training and experience, even though he was off duty, he should be commended.
Mm-hmm. I agree. The Bridgewater police and emergency medical personnel arrived on scene. After Paul Leahy acknowledged that he understood his rights, he was asked whether he had any weapons on himself. He told the officers that he had a knife in his back pocket. The knife was, of course, covered with Alexandra's blood. Paul Leahy was then transported to the Middleborough State Police Barracks. There, his bloody clothes were taken as evidence. He spent approximately 2 hours handcuffed to a bench in the booking room, dressed in a hospital gown, and facing a large print wall, posters containing Miranda warnings and information regarding arrestees' rights to make a telephone call. There's a reason I'm telling you all this.
I figured that there was.
When a state trooper assigned to the investigation arrived at the barracks, he asked Paul Leahy whether he had read the Miranda poster, whether he understood his rights, and whether he'd been previously arrested and has had those rights explained to him, which I already told you, his previous arrests.
I know, but I don't like where you're going with this because he didn't actively read him his rights.
He was read his rights when he was apprehended at McDonald's. Burger King, excuse me.
Mm-hmm. But in the interview room?
He was. Let's see. Yeah, he was.
Okay.
Yep.
Good. Yeah, I thought you were going someplace else with that.
No, well, he does try to state. I'm telling you all this to tell you how not only was he read them multiple times in multiple locations, but he sat for 2 hours.
Staring at them
as well. Plus, he has been arrested on other occasions and also read his Miranda rights at that point in time,
right, too.
And he admits, yes, I understand them, okay? The trooper then,
based off of his experience, he probably knew them better than the police
absolutely.
Officer.
Absolutely.
Police officer still has to use a card to read them.
Yeah, and he's like, here, let me help you.
And garbage goo's over here going, I got it in my head. Uh-huh.
The trooper then asked Paul if he wanted to speak to him, to which Paul responded, not right now, in a minute. I need to figure some things out.
Like a story?
Yeah, exactly. The trooper noticed that Paul had some cuts and scratches on his hands and the left side of his face and neck, and he proceeded to prepare a report with these observations as well. Those are, you know, Alexandra's defensive.
Yeah, they're defensive wounds. Hopefully they photographed him too. You don't have a right to not have your picture taken, by the way. Oh, that's not testimonial.
That's good to know.
It's not a violation of Miranda to take somebody's pictures.
Okay. Approximately 20 minutes later, the trooper approached Leahy again. And again, he said, and asked him if he would like to talk. And he says no. And the trooper says, when you need to figure things out, it's good to talk to somebody else about them. Leahy agreed to talk to an officer, and at which point he was uncuffed from the bench and brought into a conference room. He was shown and read a state police Miranda waiver form and an arraignment waiver form. After indicating that he understood the rights described by the forms, including his right to make a telephone call, and after signing them, Paul Leahy gave a statement confessing to having stabbed and robbed Alexandra. When he finished his statement, crime scene investigators took swabs from his hands and the police summoned medical personnel to treat his cuts, which were open but not actively bleeding. There were more scrapes than anything.
Sure.
I told you all that because on appeal, he does try to claim that his confession should not have been used in the trial because he was not aware of his Miranda rights. Mm. And so everything that I just read you was 100% from the appeal where they are saying, no.
His contention isn't shocking to me because when you appeal, you look for every single reason and you start with that one.
Yeah.
The appellate attorney probably knew that he wasn't going to win that part on appeal because of the evidence you just disclosed,
right.
But they still try it.
For sure. Prosecutor Frank Middleton boasted a slam dunk case against Paul Leahy.
Well, he literally was caught in the act.
He was, 100%. Middleton says the evidence is overwhelming. He thinks... thinking mostly to the testimony of Lieutenant Stephen O'Reilly, the trooper who caught him in the act of cleaning up after the murder. Among the evidence were grisly crime scene photos telling a story of bloody and violent struggle that, by the way, Alexandra is a very petite woman. She's like my size. Those photos showed her struggle and what she went through right before she died. Unfortunately, she was wearing a white blouse and pants that were completely brown from being soaked in blood. And they presented that to the jurors so that they could see, like, it truly. So I know it's awful for them to have to see that, but that's their job.
They have to.
Yep.
I understand. I was a prosecutor for many years, and I wouldn't have hesitated, no matter how insensitive it sounds, to show that.
Mm-hmm.
She was a crime scene canvas at this point.
Mm-hmm.
She literally, her own blood had painted her clothing.
Sure had. She suffered 27 knife wounds, including 5 of them that severed her aorta and jugular vein.
27. He remembers 2, though.
Yep. Remember how he's, oh, no, I just stabbed her twice in the forearm. Oh, so you don't remember the 5 that severed her aorta or the jugular vein?
Yeah, clearly he was aiming for vital organs.
Yeah, exactly. So also key to the prosecution's case was a statement that Paul Leahy made to the police, in which he confessed that he intentionally stabbed her. Again, he's confessing only to the forearm, okay? But it's still a confession of intentional stabbing.
Yeah, so that's called circumstantial evidence. He's admitted to stabbing her forearm, but no one else could have caused the other stab wounds. So the jury's given an instruction that they can consider all of the evidence surrounding that to come up with a conclusion.
Right. Like, that's weird. I don't know how the other, 25 stab wounds on her body happened, but I will admit to these 2 on her forearm.
If the process of elimination is still beyond a reasonable doubt based off of circumstantial evidence, you can convict.
Well, they do get him to admit, besides the 2 twice in the forearm, he admitted to stabbing her once in the chest once he was confronted with the autopsy results.
Oh, okay.
So we still have 24 stab wounds unaccounted for here, buddy.
Well, I think this is where you can go back to rely on his excited utterance to the law enforcement officer. I lost it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He also admitted that Alexandra fought hard, at one point headbutting him, biting him.
Good for her.
And escaping from him twice towards the door, only to be dragged back inside. Yeah. I know, no one wins in a headbutt, you guys.
No.
You have to be prepared to take on some serious pain. She fought really, really hard.
Don't you wish that she would have been carrying?
Yes.
I mean, just to be confronted with somebody with a knife outside of a bathroom at 4 o'clock in the morning.
4 a.m. in a fucking Burger King.
The shock he would have received if she pulled that out and said, this isn't a knife. Mm-hmm. This is a knife.
Right.
Right? Like.
Bang, bang, fucker. Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
And when you see
But
him,
that's me.
When you see
I don't
his
carry
picture.
Shit with me all the time. Ugh. You know, I can be completely situationally unaware. Mm-hmm. And rest areas have always made me nervous like that. I actually don't tend to go to them. If I'm traveling that early in the morning or late at night and I'm alone, I actually tend to go to the most populated restaurant I can.
Yep. Yep, me too. I don't.
Not rest areas.
I don't do
gas stations. Mm-hmm. The gas stations I go to.
Some gas stations at night creep me out.
Yeah,
too.
You have to. It has to be the right gas station.
And like you said, very populated.
Yes, lots of lights.
But I don't know how many options there were between where her car was parked that her friend dropped her off at and then Newport.
Yeah.
Paul Leahy said that during a lull in the fight, Alexandra even tried to reason with him, telling him that she would tell people that he had saved her life, like I said before. So he put all of that into the confession, okay? And he even put that he refused because he didn't think anyone would believe her. Obviously, his criminal record for rape was not admissible in court.
Why?
For his previous prior acts, it was during the sentencing phase, but not during the trial for her.
Was there sexual assault affiliated with this stuff?
No.
That might be why.
And see.
But I think violence on the prior bad acts, it's so hard because a lot of it has to do with whether or not it was convictions of untruthfulness, lying, or again, those. But in Michigan, it's not prior bad acts. It's similar acts. Mm-hmm. So if there was something violent where you had attacked somebody.
Mm-hmm. Well, and remember, he got caught strangling
rapes,
that woman.
Correct. I have some concerns as to why that may not have come in. But although I am an expert, may not be an expert in that particular location in terms of how that's worded.
Well, and the family was pretty upset because the family, Alexandra's family absolutely believes that his intent with her was a sexual assault. He didn't get that far and she fought too hard.
Correct.
They don't buy into you were just trying to rob her. Your past history indicates that this is something that you do.
I agree.
And so why would you choose this one to only rob? And actually in a victim impact statement, her stepdad gets up there. I believe it's her stepdad. I get to it in a little while, but he gets up there and says, you knew that a woman like her would never be interested in doing sexual acts with you. So I absolutely believe your intention in the beginning was sexually motivated and she fought.
Right.
And so then it pissed him off and he killed her.
Well, luckily for the prosecution, it was pretty much a no-brainer in terms mm-hmm. of the conviction, even if the prior bad acts weren't allowed in. And they were going to be allowed in for the sentencing component.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the so truly they tried, the prosecution did try to keep all of that, like the family's, you know, suspicions, all of his past sexual history, because they didn't want to, some articles that I read said that they really didn't want to sidetrack the jury. They wanted to keep the jury focused on this. He premeditated this. He had that knife on him. He watched her and then met her just as he knew she would be coming out. It was murder.
Yeah,
whether and he wants to say it's because it was he was robbing her, yeah. But whatever, it was still murder, and that's what they want the jury to convict him for.
Interesting prosecutorial tactic. Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
I might have done things differently, but.
His defense lawyer was a man named Frank Spillane. S-P-I-L-L-A-N-E. Spillane. Spillane. I don't know. Spillane. Frank.
Frank.
We're calling him Frank.
Frank is fine with me.
He did not make a case to get his client acquitted of all charges, but instead concentrated his efforts on proving that Alexandra Zapp's death was not an intentional act of murder.
Yeah, so that's a normal defense tactic. He is going for an LIO, so that is a lesser included offense. Mm-hmm. He is looking for after the evidence to be presented for him to make an argument that he should not, in fact, be convicted of first degree premeditated murder, but for perhaps some type of an assault causing death, mm-hmm. Manslaughter. Of course, they must have felony murder, which he was trying to avoid, because in most states, it's just common law, Charnel, mm-hmm. that if you commit a felony, any felony, and a death results because of you committing that felony, it doesn't matter what the original intention was, you are guilty of murder.
Okay.
So felony murder exists at the common law. I just don't know what if they have an accompanying statute. So that he's going to have a hard time getting behind, but perhaps it carries a lesser penalty, and that's what he was looking for.
That is what he was looking for, yes. What he did was he argued that Paul's action were in response to the circumstances confronting him. He said that his client did not plan, plot, or lie in wait for Alexandra Zapp.
He just carries knives around the rest area when he's on break at the BK.
Well, in his confession, he had said he watched her.
Yeah.
She had been on site. She slept there for a little while. She ordered a burger. He was the cook, so he could have absolutely seen her. She ate her burger. She went into the car and slept. And then around 4 a.m. or so, she came back in to use the restroom again before leaving. That was his he knew. I get it. He's doing his job. He's trying to refute what the prosecution is saying, of course.
He's trying to refute the premeditation.
He is, yep. So they tell the jury, of course, the defense tells the jury that, you know, Paul was waiting for Alexandra to come out of the restroom, but the reason is because he was trying to decide whether or not he was going to carry through his intention to rob her. When he came out and saw him, or excuse me, when she came out and saw him with a knife and started screaming, then Paul reacted by waving the knife to calm her down.
Oh,
because waving a knife in my face calms me down every time.
Never.
It
does, however, induce screaming.
Sure does. Sure does. He said that his client did not intend to hurt Alexandra and that the battle in the bathroom erupted spontaneously. He said that Paul was simply reacting to a situation that had spiraled out of control. Yeah, except 27 stab wounds is more than just an escalation to me. That is absolutely snapping. He said, I lost it. I lost it. Yes, you did.
Let's think about it. If the defense argument is going to work, he would have had a knife. He would have brandished the knife at her and said, give me all your money, mm-hmm. anticipating that she would give it to him and then he would just leave. Okay.
Yes.
She fights back. So even if she fought instead of giving him the money, which would have, in his argument, ended the robbery, he didn't just use his weapon to stab her a couple times in the arms to get her away, where he inevitably then would have run away. Mm-hmm. Okay. The pure fact that he stayed there and we have those very specific stab wounds, which is, I know why you gave us the information, so many of them in the chest. He was intending to end her life at some point in time. Mm-hmm. Even, again, playing devil's advocate, if he did truly just intend to rob her and it went wrong, mm-hmm. which we know is bullshit,
yes,
by
oh,
the way.
Absolutely.
No one is going to believe this that I can imagine. You actually could have a really shitty prosecutor, and I still think they'd be able to prove this case.
Yes.
Not saying that those were shitty prosecutors. They had their tactics. But still, this is not believable, but it's a nice defense attempt. If you believe that he didn't have the premeditation, it became that way, though.
Well,
he could have run away when he realized she was fighting.
Well, and here's the thing, Megan, and this is where the family has the problem. If he had simply waved the knife, asked for her money, she would have given it to him. There never would have been a reason for her to fight.
No, I agree. Here's my $25.
Yep,
leave me alone.
The fact that she was fighting shows that there was more. He was doing more, wanting more than just money, that caused her to have to fight for her body and her life.
He never just brandished the knife at her. We know that. He accosted her as soon as she was trying to get out and physically laid his hands on her. As soon as somebody grabs a hold of me, I am going to fight is my response. Some people don't. Some people try to flee. Some people freeze.
Well, and remember, there were blood droplets outside of the bathroom door.
Which would indicate he had harmed her.
Exactly.
Injured her.
Right there.
In the entryway.
Yes.
Agreed. Great point. Great evidence.
Not just waving the knife. No, he stabbed her immediately. And they have a conversation where she had said,
you stabbed me.
And it lulls enough.
She has time to try to reason.
Exactly. To try to reason with him. This isn't just a robbery.
No.
Again, you ask for the money, she would give it. She's not fighting being stabbed over $25. No. There was way more to this. He was demanding her probably to take off her clothes, whatever it may be.
Oh, I think he clearly was attempting to sexually assault her. Mm-hmm. And it went horribly wrong for him.
It did. It absolutely did. So on but none of that comes out in the trial
itself.
None of that comes out in the trial. It is all about how his intention, you know, the prosecution is leaving out the suspicions of sexual assault and the history of sexual assault, and just going with he had that knife, he lay in wait for her, and he murdered her.
Yeah, and that's smart because there's no one that can corroborate the sexual assault piece because she's not here to tell it.
And he was caught. I mean, yes, she was already deceased. We don't know what he was planning on doing with her deceased body.
Correct.
So he was interrupted before there even could be any evidence of sexual intent.
Okay.
On September 24th, 2003, Paul Leahy was red-faced and watery-eyed as he entered the courtroom. But he was very impassive as the verdict was read. A jury of 7 men and 5 women announced that they had reached a verdict after 2 hours and 15 minutes of deliberations, and they found him guilty on all charges. In the victim impact statement, her mom, Andrea, read a poem that was written in remembrance of Alexandra by her younger sister, Caroline.
Oh.
Yeah, before the sentencing.
Those are very hard to sit through.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I encourage it. All victims, anybody that wants to read a statement for sentencing purposes, always should. I will admit to you, as a human being, I don't know how some judges can sit there dry-eyed and stoic and just try to process.
Oh,
you
know.
Do try to separate yourself a little bit, but you've seen me. If you cry, I cry kind of thing. My eyes well all up and I just try to keep the water in my eyeballs.
Yep. Her mom and dad also took on a campaign, essentially, to urge for stronger laws protecting the public from criminal sexual offenders, and for which she has been a part of lobbying for since Alexandra's death in 2002. Her mom, in her victim impact statement, said, quote, "She was one of the greatest people I've ever met. She did not deserve to be tortured and executed. She did not deserve to die by a disconnect in the law." In our family, she said, "In our family, we are close enough to each other that every telephone call, every time that we say goodbye, we say I love you." And she said, "Alexandra, we love you and we will never, ever forget you." Her stepfather got up, called, addressed Paul Leahy directly, not just calling him a mean, evil person, but also telling him to be a man and look him in the eye as he spoke. And he waited for Paul to look. He would not finish his victim impact statement until Garbage Goo looked up and looked him in the eye.
I have seen situations where the judge orders the defendant to look at them too.
Mm-hmm.
You look at these people when they're talking to you. Yep. You're going to sit through this. Just like we've seen judges order them to watch videos and stuff like that as well.
Yes, exactly. And he did actually address him and said, "You're lying about what happened. I believe very much that you had asked her for a sexual favor, as I had told you earlier." He actually went on to say, "You and I both know a woman like her would have never been interested in you. So you had to try to forcibly take it, and you ended up taking her life instead." And he said, "You're a coward. You know it. I don't know what happens to evil people like you, but one day we'll all find out.
Dude, I like him.
Yeah. So, and in the, I will say, you know, of course, Lieutenant Stephen O'Reilly was a big witness for the state, right? For the prosecution. But he also just, after he was done, he was, during the sentencing, he was in the courtroom and he was hugging the family. And they were all just very grateful that he had even, you know, been there. But this affected him pretty profoundly because he gave interviews and said that, you know, yeah, obviously he's seen a lot. He's been a state trooper for 25 years.
Worked his way up to lieutenant.
Mm-hmm. But this one, I mean, I think part of the reason is just that he was off duty too. You know, he's used to detaching and responding to things for work.
He happened upon this in his real life.
His personal time, right? Yeah. And he said that he couldn't stop thinking about his own 18-year-old daughter just lying in a bathroom stall, dying like that. I mean, what a horrible place to have to die. I have a phobia of public restrooms, for crying out loud. I shouldn't call it a phobia. It's not that strong, but
it's an aversion.
It is.
It's an aversion.
And I'm only in them if it's an emergency.
Yeah.
So that would just be horrible. And that really impacted him, the way he's just like thinking about his own daughter and how awful to have died, have your last moments be in a public restroom. And he put her in a stall, Megan.
I know.
Just so awful.
I think, to put it in a perspective to those of us that work in this line, we can become desensitized to a lot of things and really have the most horrific case. And then out of the blue, something that quote unquote isn't even as bad as other things that you've seen sets you off.
Triggers you. Yeah.
There was just something about this. Maybe the fact too, you know, reconciling the fact that he has a daughter just a little bit younger than that, those type of things. But this girl was a fighter.
Yes. Yes.
The amount of respect that you have for the victim, I wish we could call her a survivor, but she fought like hell to be one.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't go without a fight.
No.
I think that says something about her. And it does really dramatically, I think, affect law enforcement when they see somebody who's their people.
Yeah.
Their people fight back, right?
Yeah.
And he couldn't save her. Can you imagine him knowing that he was in there during this whole assault in the next bathroom and it was finally when he heard the stuff that he was able to go?
Yep. Well, and in my understanding, and I have encountered this in restrooms like that too, the music was pretty loud.
Oh, yeah.
Like it wasn't, and you know, you have the sound of the toilet flushing.
Well, there's
and the
cinder
water
block
running.
Walls usually too.
Yeah, it's not so cut and dry. And you're not just going to automatically assume someone's getting murdered. Your head might even go to like, uh-oh, somebody might be fooling around in there. You know, something like that. Because everything was muffled. It wasn't a scream that, you know, this blood-curdling scream.
Well,
right?
It's kind of hard to scream when you've been stabbed multiple times in the chest.
Yes.
And have lung punctured and sucking wounds. And yeah.
Exactly. And Lieutenant O'Reilly said, here's a girl who just stopped to use a restroom. She did nothing wrong. That is all that she did. And she lost her life. And this case did prompt some changes in state laws regarding sex offenders at the time. After her murder, her mother and stepfather, Andrea Casanova and Stephen Stiles, founded the Alley Foundation in Boston in November 2002. The Alley Foundation is a 501c3 charitable organization whose mission is to prevent opportunities for violent sex offenses, to educate the public and advocate for necessary changes in culture, attitude, and policy. One of the most critical responsibilities of the Alley Foundation is to work for more comprehensive and evidence-based policies to effectively manage sex offenders as they move through the criminal justice system and into the community.
I love that. I love them. I love this because punishing all registered sex offenders does nothing. One of the things that we know historically, and you guys can disagree with me if you would like, but unfortunately I have the actual data, is that the actual SORA, the actual sex offender registry itself, has actually done nothing to help. In fact, it has often made things worse.
Mm-hmm.
It was never intended to be a public registry, by the way. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be, but it was never intended to be.
Right.
Because of the amount of seclusion then that those registered sex offenders have and the fact that they're very hard to integrate into society, it is very hard to find employment for them so that they can attempt to become productive members. This
ability to form a foundation that is looking for evidence-based practices to assist with integration. Mm-hmm. It is so progressive and not what you would expect from the family of somebody who was killed by a sex offender.
Right.
It's just not. Yes. I have a lot of respect for this, and they want to be part of the solution.
Yes.
And not perpetuate the problem. Mm-hmm. They're not saying never let sex offenders out because they know we have no control over that. Yep. There are going to be sex offenders released. And I'm going to tell you something you don't like. Some of them deserve to be released because there are circumstances involved in their prior crimes.
Well, they're not violent. Their target here is for violent sex offenders.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then how do we integrate them or reintegrate them? And how do we know what rules and policies do we put in place to differentiate them at parole hearings and such?
Yes.
So brilliant people, amazing people.
The LA Foundation is also known for their For a Change fundraising events, such as the annual Sail for a Change Flip Flop Regatta held in the Boston Harbor. Excuse me.
I want to go.
I know. I hope they still do this. I mean, this was all started in 2002.
Yeah, and lots of things ended with COVID. Mm-hmm. So I don't know post 2020 if it still exists.
Yep. But I thought that was really, really neat that not every case that we cover do we have a family that's strong enough to make something beautiful out of something so tragic, but this family has been able to do that.
What a great case suggestion.
It was. Thank you so much to the listener who suggested this.
Allie is amazing. She deserved to have this told.
Alexandra.
And well, I was going with the Allie thing.
That's the thing. I do wonder if
they called her Allie,
and that's how they ended up with the Allie Foundation name. I actually looked for that and couldn't find
it. Okay, well, we'll call her Alexandra then.
So, but I suspect that that's probably what it was. But do you want just it's not a funny brain bath. I have a warm, fluffy.
You give me wholesome sometimes, and I very much enjoy it.
I'm
going to
give you a warm bath today. So get your rubber ducky. And it happened in Michigan, too. Maybe you've seen it because it was literally in the news this week.
Maybe. Was it me? Was I involved? I'm warm and fuzzy.
You are. And so is this beautiful dog.
Oh.
It's a California dog that's been missing since the summer and was found in Michigan.
Do you think he hitchhiked across the country?
I don't know. I wonder.
Or is it like Homeward Bound and he made the great journey on foot? I could cry every time when the old dog finally comes in the yard because his owner's like, oh, yeah,
he didn't
Chance
make
is
it.
There and the cats. Yeah, I know.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
I love Homeward Bound. All right. It says a dog missing in California since the summer turned up more than 2,000 miles away in suburban Detroit. Police in Harper Woods responded to a call about a stray dog last week, picked up the terrier mix, and contacted an animal welfare group. The Grosse Pointe Animal Adoption Society said it quickly discovered that the dog, named Mishka, had an identity chip implanted in her with information about her owners. So they lived in San Diego, the owners, and they were planning to travel to Minnesota when the call came in. And so since they were already planning on going to Minnesota, they just kept on going over to Michigan.
Or a couple states over. What's another 8 hours?
That's right. Actually, it was 10 for him,
says. Oh, okay. Yep. I was off.
Just an extra 10 hours.
Well, it's 8 hours to us, so it would be 10 to the D.
So the family had actually put up over 1,000 flyers. They said that they were always on the lookout for her. They were super shocked to find out, of course, that she was found in Michigan. A veterinarian actually examined her, gave her a rabies shot, and cleared her to travel home to California. She was clean, well-fed, and so whoever had her took really good care of her.
Was she dog-napped and then got out?
Yep.
She hitch a ride somehow? I feel like somebody probably stole her.
I think somebody took her. Yep. And she had, like the vet said, it's obvious she hasn't been on the streets this whole time.
No.
She has been well cared for. And look, this is the picture of him reuniting with the owners.
Oh, my gosh. She's so cute.
Mishka so cute.
Mishka looks like Benji.
She does. She just... God,
look at that owner,
little,
how happy. Yes. They both have mustaches, the owner and Mishka. Hers is white. They're nose to nose.
It's so cute.
This is the best brain bath.
And I do think if you can, have your dogs chipped. Have your animals chipped. Because look, I mean, it's been almost a year and they were reunited.
Can you imagine getting a call from California saying, hey, Charnel, we have Maggie or Molly?
No. Oh, my God.
Can you imagine?
No.
Mm-mm. And your dog's here like, workout. Got a good workout, Mom. Yeah,
we're good.
Been traveling across country. We're good. A life's goal.
I hope that whoever did have them just found her, didn't realize. I hope that they weren't really stealing someone, you know, someone's dog. Just like, oh, I found this stray dog and now we're going to love it. And I hope they treated her well.
True. That this dog could have wandered off from her home in where whatever city she was in Cali to a different town, and somebody took in the stray instead of, you know, taking her to the pound or whatever. But
yep. So yeah, isn't that just a nice warm? I love it.
Light, I'm just staring at the picture.
So cute. So hopefully they had a wonderful transition back. Yep, to her life in California.
I don't think dogs forget their people.
No. I think that there's actually research. No,
and they can have multiple people.
Yeah.
It's easy. That's why it can be easy to rehome certain dogs. Mm-hmm. Some of them get incredibly homesick and they don't do well in a new home.
Right.
But other dogs are just like, oh, you're my new people to love.
Yep.
So.
That unconditional love that dogs have for humans.
Cats don't. I don't get it.
I don't have unconditional love for humans. Only certain ones.
Yeah,
in my life,
I'm right there with you, girl.
Oh, gosh. All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us today. We hope that you enjoyed today's episode. And thanks for supporting us by listening. We hope that you keep it curious.
And keep listening.
Oh, I should mention, if you would like to binge hundreds of more content, feel free to join our Patreon. It's in the link in the show notes.
We can keep your summer travel plans and laying on the beach and sitting in airports really entertaining.
Very entertaining. And if you don't know, we unleash our real personalities even more for Patreon.
We do.
Episodes. So
to a really weird extent.
Yes. Yep. So they have a little bit of a different flavor even than general Crime Curious episodes.
It's Charnel and Megan After Dark.
It really is. So, yeah, feel free to do that. We have a website, crimecuriouspodcast.com. You can join from there as well. And anyway.
Join our Facebook groups.
Yep. And enough bragging about ourselves.
Until next time, keep it curious.
And keep listening.
Bye-bye.